the geostrategic alignment of China, Russia, and Iran, which the late American geostrategist Zbigniew Brzezinski called America's worst-case scenario, has also entered into the express lane, particularly after the severe sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its European vassals on Russia following the Ukrainian war, which have effectively cut Russia off from the West and have accelerated Russia's strategic reorientation towards Asia and the global South. All this sets the stage for a fundamental change in the global order and very interesting and eventful times in the years and decades to come. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. After a white 18-year-old teenager wearing military gear and live streaming with a helmet camera opened fire with a rifle at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York, killing 10 people and wounding 3 others, U.S. President Joe Biden claimed racially motivated hate crime was abhorrent to the very fabric of the nation. We now present you an article written by Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Mass Shooting Comes Amid Rise in Racial Violence in United States." The story is by now nauseatingly familiar. From Charleston to El Paso, Texas. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to San Diego, California. And from Christchurch, New Zealand to the latest scene of horror in Buffalo, New York. Each of these mass shootings is stitched with one common thread: white supremacy. As investigators begin to piece together the details of last Saturday, May 14th massacre at the Tops Friendly Market that killed 10 people, the motivation of the murderer already seems in little doubt. The perpetrator appears to be a radicalized, lone, white teenage gunman, filled with racial hatred fueled by extremist theory widely available on the internet, who descended on a predominantly black community in Buffalo, New York, heavily armed and determined to kill as many people as he could. The suspect, Peyton Gendron, an 18-year-old teenager, is said to have etched a racial insult onto the barrel of his assault rifle before he live-streamed himself gunning down grocery shoppers, supermarket staff, and a security guard. Authorities said he also posted a lengthy manifesto to social media with frequent references to a racist white replacement theory as justification for what they said was a hate crime and a racially motivated violent extremism. U.S. President Joe Biden, scores of American politicians and community and civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, were quick to express their outrage, calling for more to be done to tackle the rise in hate-based crime in the United States. In a statement, President Biden said, "We still need to learn more about the motivation for the shooting as law enforcement does its work, but we don't need anything else to state a clear moral truth. A racially motivated hate crime is abhorrent to the very fabric of this nation." President Biden said, any act of domestic terrorism, including an act perpetrated in the name of a repugnant white nationalist ideology, is antithetical to everything we stand for in America. Hate must have no safe harbor. We must do everything in our power to end hate-fueled domestic terrorism. But it's a problem that has been getting worse in recent years, largely cultivated in the cauldron of the darkest reaches of the internet and eagerly seized upon by those all too willing to convert the skewed ideology into violence. The FBI reported last year that the hate crimes in the United States had risen to the highest level in 12 years, triggered largely by a surge in assaults on black and Asian Americans. And while mass murderers such as those in Buffalo, New York, and elsewhere understandably garnered the most attention, many thousands of other violent hate-based attacks take place each year, leading Attorney General Merrick Garland to make domestic terrorism and racially based hate crimes a top priority for the Justice Department. Derek Johnson, president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, said in a statement following the Buffalo, New York attack, "Hate and racism have no place in America. We are shattered, extremely angered, and praying for the victims' families and loved ones, as well as the entire community." The parallels of Buffalo are significant not only to the August 2019 murder of 21 people at a Walmart store in El Paso, Texas, but also to countless other shooting incidents involving a radicalized, solitary attacker. In El Paso, Texas, the gunman, a 21-year-old white male, also posted a document online to extremist online message board 8chan, which stated the attack in the border town was a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas. 4 years earlier, an attack on a black community church by a self-confessed white supremacist in Charleston, South Carolina, left at least 9 people dead. In October of 2018 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a white man shouted, "All of you must die," as he burst into the Tree of Life synagogue and shot dead 11 worshippers, as well as wounding 6 other individuals. And a similar mass shooting incident occurred at a synagogue in San Diego, California, in April of 2019, when one person died and several others were wounded by a 19-year-old teenager who also posted messages of racial hatred to 8chan. The San Diego killer claimed he was motivated by attacks on 2 mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, a month earlier, in which a white supremacist murdered 51 Muslims. Investigators there quickly established the killer had been radicalized online, had posted his own manifesto of hatred, and live-streamed the killings. To Reverend Al Sharpton, the veteran civil rights activist and television host, the latest attack in Buffalo, New York, is an urgent call to action. Reverend Al Sharpton said in a tweet, "President Biden should have a White House meeting of black, Jewish, and Asian leaders to underscore the federal government's escalating efforts against hate crimes." Reverend Al Sharpton added, "These hate crimes need to be met with a united front against hate-based violence." Meanwhile, the mayor of Buffalo, New York, said on Sunday, 15th of May, he believed the murders in his city will prove a turning point. Byron Brown said on NBC's Meet the Press program, he said, "I would like to see sensible gun control in America. I would like to see ending hate speech on the internet, on social media. It is not free speech. It is not the American way." The mayor of Buffalo, New York, Byron Brown, claimed, "We are not a nation of haters. We are not a nation of hate. We need to send a message that there is no place in the internet for hate speech, for hate indoctrination, for spreading hate manifestos. I will be a stronger voice for that. I believe that what happened in Buffalo, New York yesterday is going to be a turning point. I think it's going to be different after this in terms of the energy and the activity that we see.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghla was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of a culture and people who have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shireen Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Selkirk. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalist is set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
On May 10, 2021, Israel began an offensive on the Gaza Strip that went on for 11 days. The regime razed several buildings in the meantime, including a tower housing the bureaus of several news outlets, including Al Jazeera's. The bombings killed over 250 Palestinians in the besieged enclave, including dozens of women and children. But this time, unlike other incidents where Israel launched attacks on the Strip, Palestinian resistance movement struck back hard, killing at least 12 Israelis.
We have to remember that while there have been deaths on both sides, the deaths of Palestinians far outnumber those of the Israelis, probably by close to 1,000 to 1. So there is not a lot of importance given to Palestinian lives. This has been an ongoing, longstanding policy of the world. It's completely unjust. It ignores international law and human rights, but this has been the case. But any efforts to bring rights to the Palestinians, rights that they are entitled to by international law simply because they live, because they exist, will be opposed because no other country wants to risk its economic ties with Israel.
The conflict had been in the making for several weeks prior, when Israeli troops intensified their crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The protests that had erupted at the regime's attempt to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah also escalated tensions. The devastating conflict ended in an Egypt-brokered ceasefire that went into effect on May 21st. The battle, however, significantly altered the perceptions about the military capabilities of Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The 2021 confrontation is widely hailed as a victory for Hamas and other resistance movements in Gaza, not only militarily and on the ground, but also morally on an international level. Demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood were held across the world. A wider and more diverse group of people around the globe called for an end to the conflict and Israel's aggression, which helped raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians to a much higher extent.
Israeli invisibility can mean a number of things. You're referring to militarily, but there's also the invincibility that it had for so many years as being seen as the victim, the innocent victim just trying to defend itself. That has certainly been shattered. People around the world, even if they support Israel, see Israel as the aggressor.
A year on, Tel Aviv is once again intensifying the pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli forces and settlers have repeatedly raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound over the past few weeks, a location that's considered Islam's third holiest site. In response, there has been a spike in the number of deadly Palestinian retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. Palestinians say the attacks are a natural response to Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa, an issue they warn is their red line. The mounting tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are raising fears about another confrontation. But the events over the past couple of years have indicated that Palestinians will continue to fight for what they believe in and that they can inflict pain on the other side, too.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Nakba or catastrophe, as that black day in history is called, saw illegal Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe drive away around a million Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, from their homes and hearths after massacring many Arabs and razing villages to rubble. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, Usurper Israel's Fast Approaching End. Here's the story. Mankind may have mastered science and technology and is trying to explore outer space, but it is neither in control of its dangerously destructive tendencies that it disrupt its delicate nature, nor does it make any attempt at soul-searching to discover its innate self that is unrelated to human anatomy and falls within the realm of the spirit. As a result, despite industrial progress and material amenities, which the nexus of the politicians and the scientists have for long misused, the world continues to be a hate-filled place where crimes gather and terrorism rules the roost. This alienation from humanitarian values and lust for satanic sentiments led to ignorance of the teachings of the prophets of God, an emergence of such mass murderers as Nimrud, the Pharaoh, Attila, the Genghis Khan, and later history of genocidal regimes, the most murderous, along with the now defunct Baathists of Saddam, being the illegal Zionist entity that was planted in Palestine in mid-May 1948.
We'll be right back.
Nakba or catastrophe, as that Black Day in history is called, saw illegal Jewish migrants from Eastern Europe drive away around 1 million Palestinians, both Muslims and Christians, from their homes and hearths, after massacring many Arabs and razing villages to rubble. In the preceding 2 years, waves of European Zionist terrorists had indulged in the near-total destruction of the harmonious Muslim-Christian society, seizing some 78% of historic Palestine, ethnically cleansing and destroying about 530 villages and cities, and killing over 15,000 Palestinians in a series of mass atrocities, including more than 70 organized massacres with British approval. It is now 74 years, and usurper Israel, with the support of the U.S. and West European regimes, continues its genocide, coupled with desecration of the holy sites of Islam and Christianity. On May 15th, on the heels of its cold-blooded murder of prominent Christian journalist Shirin Abu Aghile, whose funeral was savagely attacked and her coffin defiled, it unleashed armed gangs of illegal Zionist migrants to attack peaceful Palestinian protesters and to violate the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This year, conscientious people of other religions, including many Jews, who consider the illegal birth of Israel against the tenets of Judaism and denounce the Zionists as godless, joined Muslims all over the world to commemorate the Nakba anniversary with placards in bold letters reading, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." They seem to be echoing the call of the leader of the Islamic Revolution for the most logically peaceful solution that the UN and its manipulators are trying to ignore, despite the fact the massive road rallies, which on Saturday, May 13th, in London, numbered over 10,000, and which on Sunday, May 14th, saw several thousand Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims take to the streets of the U.S. cities, including New York, Boston, Washington and Michigan, the Canadian cities including Montreal and Toronto, and the Australian cities including Sydney and Melbourne, chant "Free, Free Palestine." Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has suggested a democratic referendum involving all indigenous inhabitants, including Muslims, Christians and Jews, but not the non-Semitic illegal Zionist migrants from Europe and the Americas, to set up a unified government for a single Palestinian state, stretching from the borders of Lebanon in the north to the Sinai Peninsula in the south, and from the banks of River Jordan in the east to the shores of the Mediterranean Sea in the west. If this gross historical wrong is not rectified, the Zionist regime will definitely meet an ignominious end more catastrophic than the Nakba, and the Zionists, irrespective of their origin, will rue the day they were born or had been misled by this devilish anti-Muslim, anti-Christian ideology, and anti-human ideology.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic.
Well, you must be following news related to the nuclear matter. As I have said before, and as other government officials have said before, including Mr. President, who has repeatedly stressed this matter, you must not at all wait for the nuclear negotiations when doing your planning. You must not wait for it in any way. Do your work, look at the current condition of the country, and do your planning accordingly. The negotiations might reach a certain point, positive, half positive, or negative. Whatever happens, you must do your own work and you must not make your affairs contingent upon the negotiations. Fortunately, the Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs and the negotiating team delivered their detailed reports to the President and the Supreme National Security Council. They are being updated on the matters and therefore they will make a decision. They think and consider the various aspects of the matter. Of course, it is all right to criticize these officials and express one's viewpoint. But first of all, you should take care not to express viewpoints in a pessimistic manner. I have always said to officials in all administrations that our attitude towards the people in the middle of the arena should not be pessimistic and cynical attitude. Well, there are pious, revolutionary, diligent, and hardworking people in the arena. And they are working in this regard. If one wishes to make a criticism, it has to be an optimistic, not pessimistic one. Secondly, it must not undermine the people who are busy working in this arena. The people's hope should not be undermined either. In other words, we should not speak in a way that the people lose their hope.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, our negotiating team has thankfully resisted the other side's bullying, and by God's favor, and without any doubt, they will continue to resist. He who has broken his promise is the other side. They themselves have faced serious problems because of having violated their promises. In the present time, the other side, which broke its promises and which tore the deal to pieces, as they themselves put it, is stuck in a dead end. We do not thankfully feel stuck in a dead end. We have managed to endure the hardships and pass through them. We have passed through many problems so far, and we will pass through other problems from now on too, God willing.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities and membership in any political party or group due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulema and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the U.S., hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the U.S. started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like The Deluge and the story of Joseph and Zuleika in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it? But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too." The noble prophet demolished the Zarar Mosque. That we are opposed to cinema, it means we are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "Radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy, and for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists. They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters. Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, "Have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation?" Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Sharing the same mindset toward the U.S., Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrizas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac's been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts made by Iranian and Cuban scientists. We're determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus 1. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.